Hi, this is Jerry DiPiano from Femme Pharma, and you are listening and watching the Love Mia Vita podcast. Today, my guest is a frequent guest on the Love Mia Vita podcast, Dr. Dana Shanice of V Health and Wellness. And Dr. Shanice is also a member of our Medical Advisory Council at Femme Pharma Consumer Healthcare. Welcome, Dana.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, my pleasure. And so today we are discussing a topic that is often lumped together with many different kinds of issues that fall under what women often hear as low libido. But we're trying to unpack that a little bit and sort of break out, what does this mean? When we hear low libido, what are we really dealing with here? So Dr. Shanice, who is an expert in OBGYN and an expert in women's healthcare, is going to help us to unpack many of these issues that are lumped under this category of low libido or lack of interest. It sort of all seems to be one condition. And so Dr. Shanice, tell us about what we should be thinking about when we hear this, I'm not interested in intercourse, or I have a low libido, or I'm suffering with, you know, lack of, you know, motivation to engage in sexual intercourse.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think to understand where libido plays a role in the sexual cycle, we kind of have to take a step back and think about all the steps that go into healthy sexual activity. And so traditionally, you know, decades ago, we kind of thought that the sexual cycle was very linear, that it would start with a desire, and that would typically be a thought, you know, either spontaneous or instigated by pornography or something. And then that would lead to arousal, and that would lead to orgasm, and then a resolution or refractory period. What we have learned in the decades of studying sexual function, especially in females, is that it is not linear. It's kind of all over the place. So for some people, sexual interest actually begins with physical touch or arousal, or even the sexual act. You know, so it's not as cut and dry as interest is the first step. And so when we talk about low libido, in general, libido we think of as interest in having sex, spontaneous desire to have sex. And initially, that was kind of its own dysfunction. We had that listed as hypoactive sexual desire disorder. But we have kind of revised that due to the knowledge of how complex the process is. And that's why I think a lot of the confusion exists. So typically, I have a lot of patients that come in and they say that I have low libido and that's their primary complaint. But often it's actually the arousal process that is the issue that can lead to pain, which also then does not give good feedback. If sexual activity is not pleasurable, if it's painful, if there is anxiety, if there are any negative emotions or feelings related to it, that may feed back and decrease your libido. So the first step in kind of figuring out, is libido the issue, even if that feels like the issue, is to kind of take apart what sexual activity looks like for you. And that involves thinking about not only sexual activity with your partner or partners, but also masturbation or self-pleasure as well, and kind of start to tease apart the different parts of the sexual cycle. So sorry, I don't think I answered your question. I think I brought up a lot more questions there.
You did answer the question, because again, when we have this conversation with other members of the lay community, we often hear it lumped under one category. And I think that you've broken it down. So we started off historically with looking at hypoactive sexual disease disorder. That is a bit pathologized. And then we talked about what is female sexual disorder, so FSD. And then we look at something called FSIAD, which is the interest and arousal disorder. And that's really where we want to focus some of our emphasis today, because it is different from what I just mentioned in the past. And we've learned a lot about it. So as an example, even the incidence and prevalence of those two conditions are different. So in terms of looking at this, there is a study that was done called the PRESIDE study, where they looked at low sexual desire, and that was reported in about 37.7% of women. It was a significant number of women that were actually interviewed. However, there's the low desire with distress. So if it is impacting you and it is causing distress, that was reported in about 10% of women, still not insignificant. So let's maybe spend some time talking about FSIAD, and then there are some other conditions that we will discuss on a subsequent podcast, where we also want to entertain ways in which to address this and address each of these because they are very different.
Yeah, so I think it's really important. That distinction that you made is actually necessary for the diagnosis. So what we find in general in every human being, there are variations in our libido and our arousal, not just between people, but even over an individual's lifetime. There are situations that might cause libido to rise and fall, not just age-related, but different factors within your life, like when children leave the nest, things like that. And so we find that that is very fluid. And so I do have a lot of patients that come in and say, I don't have libido. And I say, well, does that bother you? And they say, no. And so in order, you know, the one of the very important things to know is that variation is normal. And if it does not bother you, it does not necessarily mean that something is wrong. Now, if all of a sudden something rapidly changes, it's still valuable to discuss that because that could be a sign of something either physiologic, medically, or mental health wise that is going on. But in order for these issues to be considered a disorder or be in any of these dysfunction categories, it has to cause you distress. And one thing I want to talk about here, which is a slightly off topic, but important to know, is that there is a concept called libido mismatch. And that is where one partner may have either higher or lower libido or sex drive than the other one. In terms of our medical diagnoses, a libido mismatch is not one of these disorders because it does not cause distress to the individual. It is a relationship issue. So while there are things that we can do to evaluate, you know, there are patients that come and say, I never really had a high libido, but my partner, you know, has a high libido and they want me to have more desire. And, you know, there may be some things that we can do to affect desire, but we are not likely going to make you a different person. And so if your natural libido is not very high, we are not going to try to push that because that is just not who you are. That really involves relationship factors, counseling, and things like that to deal with the libido mismatch. So in that case, you know, that's a case where it's not necessarily causing you distress, but you may be having a mismatch in that case. But when we're talking about the FSIAD, there are different ways that that can present. And we basically lump that those two together in our field, both interest and arousal, because it is extremely difficult to tease them apart. And so in general, if you do not have the desire to engage in sexual activity, you may have decreased arousal. And when we talk about arousal, the main things that we're looking for is increased blood flow to the genital organs, so to the vagina, to the clitoris, increased lubrication and relaxation of the vaginal muscles. And so that is something that may occur before the mental feeling of desire or interest in participating with sexual activity. And so we can kind of separate those two out with a bit of discussion and finding out where this started and in what situations this occurs as well.
So it's important to try to do a diagnostic to determine whether this is in fact what's going on, as opposed to perhaps looking at something that is more anatomical, physiological, because of some anatomical problem or some physiological problem that an individual woman is experiencing. And as you were talking about interest and arousal disorder and mismatched libidos, if your partner is chasing you around the house because, and if you're with a male partner, he is using an erectile dysfunction product, that can be pretty scary, I would imagine.
Yeah. That's one of the things that we see in heterosexual couples that come to my office a lot, is that they're often, when the male has been having issues, their issues get addressed very rapidly. And there are some, you know, good medications for that. And that changes the dynamic of how these things go. You know, I have a lot of patients who has had low sexual activity with their partner for years and years because it wasn't addressed. And then all of a sudden they correct their issue. And now they're having to address frequent intercourse where they are experiencing chafing or pain associated with that, or just simply don't have the desire to be as sexually active as their partner now may want to be. This is what I love about treating sexual health, that it's so multifactorial. And really, the way that you have to think of it is to break it down. So much of what I do is listen to the patient kind of describe the circumstances in which this happens. So the first thing that kind of to differentiate, is it only with your partner or also by yourself? Or if you have more than one partner, is it only with one partner that this occurs? Did it happen in the past? Is it something new? Or have you always had this issue? And you know, what other things have occurred along the way? One of the most common reasons for low interest is actually medications. And a lot of people are not counseled on that when they start certain medications. And so all of a sudden, you know, I hear this at least once a day, that, you know, there was some depression or anxiety and they started an SSRI, and all of a sudden they have no more interest, or all of a sudden they're having difficulty achieving orgasm, or, you know, the serotonin system and all of the neurotransmitters affect every stage of the sexual cycle, not just interest. And so, you know, it's important to kind of look at all these factors and think about kind of as clearly as we can to break it down to what specific situations this is occurring in, and what other things have happened that might cause that to be the case. And so one thing that, you know, we do look at the physiological as well, you know, vulvovaginal atrophy or the genitourinary syndrome of menopause can decrease blood flow and can decrease lubrication and comfort. And so that can affect physiologically the arousal process as well as orgasm, which can then feed back directly and indirectly. Menopause hormone changes can also affect direct interest, but it can feed back that sex is less pleasurable. And then the feedback system, we're not getting those dopamine hits that we want from the sexual activity. And so the drive does go down related to that as well. So I think that in looking at this, there's not a simple kind of if X, Y, and Z, it's this part or this part. It really is on an individual basis, kind of looking at all of those factors and seeing what we think is the beginning of the problem. And so that is why the history and, you know, for those listening, if you can really sit down and think of those factors yourself, of when it started, who you're involved with, does it happen on your own, kind of what the progression was, when you talk to your providers, you know, often you may have to find a sexual health specialist like myself, you'll be able to kind of get to that answer a lot quicker.
We often think about the lack of coordination of care, and let's be honest, it exists. It's a real thing. And so perhaps you are being treated for a chronic disease or disorder. Perhaps you're being treated by a rheumatologist for a condition like Sjogren's syndrome or for lupus, or perhaps you have undergone chemotherapy and radiation. And if you're not communicating those things to your gynecologist, and if it's impacting what you perceive as low libido, when it really is something that has to do with the chronic condition, which I consider cancer to be chronic, and some of these other autoimmune diseases, then you perhaps are missing an opportunity. So I believe that what Dr. Shanice, what Dana is recommending, is that if you are not having these conversations with your gynecologist, you should be. You should report all of these things, because it can aid in your diagnosis, and it can also aid in what is done or what is possible in terms of helping to resolve these issues.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I do want to say that even in general OBGYN or women's healthcare in general, in our training, we are not taught a lot about sexual health in detail. And it's also a rapidly evolving field. So it is one of those things that it definitely should be brought up. And really, I think it should be brought up with your primary care doctors, with your rheumatologist, with your oncologist. Even if they don't know the answers, it still may help them with their next patient. When they say, what might I expect? They might be able to say, well, a lot of our patients experience sexual issues, and this is where they have gone for help, or, you know, these are the things to look out for. So I think that it's really important to have that conversation, but it can be really hard to have that conversation. Typically, you know, at most annual exams with your gynecologist, they're going to say, are you sexually active? And then might say, do you have pain or dryness? That's typically what they're going to ask you. So it's always tough when onus is on you to kind of say, well, actually, you know, what does sexual activity even mean? And also, this is how my experience is going, and this is why I'm not happy with that. And the more that we talk about that with our providers, the more they'll realize that there's a need for them to understand if they don't already. And get you to the place where you need to be. Our field of sexual health for men has been thriving for a while because there's a lot of money to be made in that area. But female sexual health is at a point where we're really realizing the importance to quality of life and overall health and wellness, that the role that sexuality plays in that. And so the field has just expanded recently, and there's so much good research, so many really smart people who are getting into this field. And those of us who you know, love it and read all of the new research and keep up on it, are every week I'm finding a new option to offer my patients that might get them to where they want to be. So, you know, there are answers, and there are those of us who have an interest in this to keep learning and to keep helping. But you may not find that with your standard providers yet. I do hope in the future that's going to become more part of the training because of how important it is. But we are not there yet.
So there is underway among the American Medical School Student Association an initiative to really drive that forward. And without specifying which university medical schools are embarking upon this, there are several university medical schools where they are adding this to the curriculum for the very reasons that you stated. That is that if you don't receive the training in medical school and or in your fellowship training or your residency, it becomes quite difficult. And perhaps you're struggling with your own issues regarding sexual health and sexuality. And let's face it, that can impede your ability to ask the right questions and to feel comfortable with your patients. And of course, if you're the doctor wearing the white coat and you're embarrassed, that's not going to help me, who's sitting on the other side of the table, when you try to ask me a question about my sexual health and sexual wellness. So I think that this is, you know, there's a bi-directional nature to this, right? So it starts with having you think about your own sexuality and feeling like you're in a good place and comfortable, or working on that. Perhaps you as a as a healthcare practitioner need to work on that?
Well, I am very lucky that, you know, I grew up in a very sex positive house with my mother, who's a doctor, who, you know, never had shame in discussing these topics and has been married to my husband, not my husband, sorry, my father for over 50 years. And I do know that they still have a very happy sex life. And so, you know, I personally did not have that shame or biases. But I think that in general, in part of the process of learning to be a sexual health provider was understanding how to ask these questions and to, no matter what the answer is, understand that that there isn't shame in whatever that person is interested in, as long as nobody is getting hurt that has not consented to the activity. So, you know, I think that is one of the important things about being trained in this, is that, you know, as an OBGYN, I get asked all the time, are you bothered by being on my period or when I have an infection? Or, you know, I used to deliver babies and I've had amniotic fluid splattered all over my face. And, you know, and these things, because it's part of your training and what you are supposed to do, it's not gross. It's not personal. You know, it is part of what we do to help our patients. And we really don't mind that. And I find that with sexual health, patients are shocked when I ask them really specific questions that are important for determining, you know, if with this toy you are able to get aroused, but not with this, you know, to figure out what might be going on. You know, they're surprised, but this is not about embarrassment. This is not about shame. This is really about trying to understand the situation so that we can help. And, you know, there are so many factors that go into how we look at sexual activity, our, you know, our upbringing, our religion, society, medical experiences we've had before, our partner, you know, there are so many things that go into that, that teasing that apart as a provider takes work. And I think as a patient as well. But I think that's why, you know, when I do talks on this topic for a lot of women's health providers, they don't really want to treat these issues. They're like, we'll just send them to you because they are not confident that they can necessarily turn off those biases or, you know, be able to get down to the bottom without, you know, with the knowledge and the experience they have. So I really hope that more people will be trained early on so they can practice and they can really work on thinking about their own biases and you know, how they view things so that we can then treat patients the way that we are supposed to as providers, which is from a non-biased, non-judgmental position.
You know, we did talk about heterosexual couples, and unfortunately you talk about the training and the lack of training, even as we think about members of the LGBTQ plus community. And I'm mindful of that because I am aware that there is a lot of difficulty in having these kinds of conversations with members of the LGBTQ plus community. So there's so much work that needs to be done in terms of having the ability to understand, to be empathetic, and to be able to work through some of these issues, because these are issues, sexual health issues are faced not just by heterosexual couples, but by couples in general.
Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think the amount of research in these populations is starting to grow, but we don't have a lot of information on how relationships differ depending on the gender and sexuality of the involved people. But what I would say is, in my mind, that makes it even more important. And to be honest, when I have a conversation about the specifics of their sexual activity, we use the term penetration rather than just you know, sexual intercourse. And that can be, penetration is not always from another partner. There can be self-penetration. There can be penetration from a female partner. There can be penetration with a toy, even from a male partner. So, you know, I think that by kind of taking out the kind of what we assume heterosexual couples are doing, which is actually, there's a wide array anyway, you may kind of start to be able to see people of other genders, other sexualities, because a lot of the system is the same regardless of your partner. And so I think that it makes it even more important for us to have this conversation, you know, as well as having the research on these populations, so we know specifically what concerns might be more common in these populations. But I think that the underlying mental health, physiological, psychological, kind of all of that is probably very similar, regardless of who your partner or your partner's gender.
And we haven't talked about younger women who are experiencing these problems, because we tend to think, well, this is a problem that primarily affects women who are aging or in perimenopause and menopause. And that's true, because we know that the estrogen levels are dropping and that the tissues are affected, and that may cause some physiological pain, as you just mentioned. But for younger women, there is also some distress because they are younger. And the theory is that because you're younger, you should be sexy and active, and you should be engaged in sexual activity often, early and often and late, whatever. And so it can be distressing, because if you see this on TV and you hear about it from your friends, then perhaps you feel like you're an anomaly, but it does affect younger women.
It does. It actually affects women of all ages. And, you know, what is interesting is as we get to the older ages, there is in general lower sexual interest and lower sexual desire, but often that doesn't cause distress. And so it is a lot of the time is the younger patients or the perimenopausal that are most distressed by these changes. So absolutely, it is not just an issue with older females. It can happen at any age. And, you know, there are certain life events that kind of that we find affect these factors throughout life. And we find a dip in actually before menopause as well. And we think that may be related to some childbearing issues, that when you have young kids, often the environment is not conducive to a strong sex life. So, you know, it really, I have patients that are in their 20s. I have many in their 30s, 40s, 50s. My oldest patient is 90. Actually, I just saw a 98-year-old the other day, and she just wants to keep living her life you know, and I want to help her in any way I can.
It's wonderful. Good on her.
Yes, I love it. Absolutely.
I love it. And, you know, you mentioned life events, and let's face it, if you have young children, perhaps you're not getting enough sleep. So the only thing you can think about is sleep, not, you know, jumping in bed with your partner and, you know, having, you know, something, you know, having something go on, you know. So it's probably that couple that are struggling too with some low, what would consider low sexual desire, or perhaps FSIAD. There is some distress, but, you know, that can be helped by getting some sleep.
Well, yes. I mean, of course, sleep deprivation is not going to help anything, you know, health-wise. But there's a complexity to that. And this, it brings up another interesting thing, which is relationships. So what we find is that relationship or lack thereof greatly affects these factors too. And what's really interesting is at younger ages, not having a partner seems to increase the likelihood of distress or of concerns, but the longer that you are with a partner, the lower the sexual satisfaction gets. So that, you know, even when we have that comfort and everything, really the novelty can go away a little bit, and that can negatively affect our desire and things like that. So one of the things about the childbearing years is not only are you exhausted and you know, and that, but you also, it's a time of a lot of relationship issues, a lot of arguments. You know, you may not be parenting in the same way. Your schedules might now be shifted if you're doing, you know, the night feeds and your partner is sleeping and then, you know, goes off to work or whatever it might be, that there can be relationship issues around that time as well. So it's so complicated because that also plays a role, and that is not an individual factor. You know, that is our relationships. And so that is important to also keep in mind when we're looking at desire and arousal over the years, is that it's not just physiology, it's not just psychology, it's also relationships.
So Dana, what are the three key points that you would like our listeners and viewers to take away from the conversation on FSIAD, which is the interest and arousal disorder? We are going to continue this conversation on a part two, where we talk about some of the other conditions and then what can be done. But what are your three points?
So I would say that, first of all, if you think that you're having an issue, try to think about the situations in which it occurs. If you feel that something has changed, or if it's always been this way, if it's with yourself and a partner, or just with a partner, and try to think about that context and bring that information with you when you talk to a provider. I would also say that if you are not engaging in self-pleasure or masturbation, that is really, really valuable. One, to help stimulate the sexual cycle without the stress and extra factors that a partner brings into the mix. But that also helps us figure out if this is a pervasive problem or limited to certain situations. And it can help libido and arousal by stimulating that sexual cycle to be more efficient. So definitely masturbate. And then I would say the third thing is that I would have open conversations with any partners. And I really strongly recommend a good sexual health therapist. And if you can find one that is ASEX certified, that is helpful, because the effect of having issues with your sexual function can really affect your self-esteem and your quality of life as well as relationships. And so even though it is really important to talk to a provider and figure out what else is going on, talking to a sex therapist will help you get through that quicker and help you communicate your needs and desires with your partner in the most effective way. So I would recommend that too, if you're having any concerns.
Those are great tips. And I would add that if you have a provider, even if you really like your provider, but if he or she is not asking you the right questions and or helping you, find a sexual health provider like Dr. Shanice, who feels the need to unpack these issues, who is comfortable unpacking these issues. They are available to you. And Dana, you're at V Health and Wellness. In fact, you're the CEO of V Health and Wellness. Dana is a gynecologist, and I'm sure she would be happy to have this conversation with you, either in person if you happen to live somewhere in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or even in Delaware. And if not, then you can certainly set something up through telehealth. But Dr. Shanice, I want to thank you so much for being my guest on the Love Me Evita podcast. We hope that all of our listeners and viewers have enjoyed this and have learned something from us. Check us out on fempharma.com. Listen to our podcast, our blog, and check out our website. Dr. Shanice, thank you again. And remember to love Mia Vita.
Thanks so much.